Funding for THINK comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to THINK on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What astonishing physical attributes and abilities allow marine animals to thrive in extreme conditions, and how might those adaptations be useful to those of us who live on land? From detachable and regenerating limbs to bioluminescent bodies to the curious advantages of broadcast reproduction, the organisms in our oceans have both fascinated and inspired scientists looking to safeguard the environment and make human existence healthier and more comfortable. Writer and consultant Alan Prager is the former chief scientist at the undersea research facility Aquarius Reef Base in the Florida Keys. Her new book is called Sex, Drugs, and Sea Slime, The Ocean's Oddest Creatures and Why They Matter. Alan, welcome to THINK.
Hi, thanks so much, Chris.
So some of the most fascinating creatures in the ocean are actually invisible to the naked eye, or nearly so, but extremely important to the overall health of the oceans. Can you talk a little bit about the role that planktons play?
Sure. Plankton, typically we think of plankton as sort of phytoplankton and zooplankton. That's the drifting plants and animals that are pretty much microscopic or maybe a little bit bigger. And they are, within the ocean ecosystem, the base of the food web. So from there, you know, the bigger animals eat them and the bigger fish eat them and the seals and whales and eat the plankton as well as the fish that eat them. So they're really at that base of the food web.
Mm-hmm. And right now, moving a little bit up the size chain, we don't think about krill as being good eating for people, but in fact, they might find their way to our hotel, hottest restaurants, rather, sometime in the near future.
That's right, krill. Well, it turns out that each small krill, which is kind of a shrimp-like organism, is 50 to 60% protein, and they contain omega-3 fatty acids. So some people believe that they are sort of not only the next wonder health supplement, could be the next wonder food, you know, a little, krill and crab chowder, a little, you know, protein added to your salad.
What do they taste like?
You know, honestly, I haven't tasted them, but I suspect, you know, they're like little tiny shrimps. Probably don't, because they're pretty small.
Yeah.
They probably, you know, don't taste that great. But some people think that it will be the greatest fishery on the planet, which is a little concerning because so many animals in the ocean also depend on them.
Yeah, we have to be really careful not to overfish certain things, and that's been a problem with conchs, is that right?
Well, it has been a problem with conch as well as many other fish and animals. Conch, in the tropics, I mean, if you go down to the tropics somewhere, a lot of times you'll see conch on the menu, but it was a staple, a very important source of protein for many communities in the tropics. But we really overfished it. If you go to the Bahamas or Belize or Bonaire, you might see huge stacks of conch shells. And it just hits you. How could we have just taken so many out of the sea?
Mm. We all know how beautiful they are. And when you go on vacation, you know, someone will sell you one on the beach, or you might be lucky enough to find an empty conch shell. What do they look like? What are their bodies like inside those beautiful pink shells?
Well, for anybody who's ever tried to take one out and clean it, to cook it, well, first thing you notice is they are covered in slime.
Slime is a big theme in this book, we should say.
I know. Well, you know, the thing is, I honestly, even though I've been studying the ocean for, you know, 2 decades, I never realized how many animals in the ocean are either used, deployed, or are made up of slime. And the conch is a great example. When you go to clean it, and it's not like just, you get a little sticky. This stuff is so gooey that you need like lemon or vinegar to cut it off get it off your hands.
Huh.
And, you know, they use it like a lot of creatures. They probably use it to defend themselves against predators. They may use it to slick in their path. Trails of slime and sand are probably what attracts mates. So very important. They also have, it's actually, if you see them underwater, they have these really cool yellow-stalked eyes.
Hmm.
They're very interesting. They have a snout that they feed on algae. And one of the things I learned, the males are especially well-endowed.
Yeah. there's a photograph in the book, and I have to say that the book absolutely benefits from the fact that there are lots of color pictures inside. I had never thought about how a lady conch and a gentleman conch make a baby conch before.
Well, who would have? Well, it was really funny because I know a biologist who's been studying conch for a long time, and I sent him a note. And I said, Al, his name is Al Stoner, said, hey, do you have any really interesting facts about the conch, you know, that the public might find interesting? And he sent me this great email back that said, well, there's a real advantage to studying the reproductive biology of an animal that is big, slow, mates for hours on end, and has a penis half its body length. Which, of course, you know, that was just hysterical. And so I started, you know, researching a little bit more about their reproductive strategies. And it turns out the conch biologists have known this, and they're like funny limericks written about it. They call it The Verge. You know,
that's the name of the organ. The Verge is the name of the organ that we're talking about.
Right.
Mm-hmm. and mating of other things I hadn't thought about before I read this book, including corals. I never thought about how corals reproduce.
Well, corals, it's very interesting because if you look at them out on a reef, you know, a lot of times actually they kind of look like rocks,
mm-hmm.
but they're actually colonies of small animals. And they, we call it sort of, it's a synchronized mass spawning. And what they do is at the same time, around the same night every year on a reef, the corals release egg and sperm into the water. They float up, mix, and the eggs get fertilized. And one of the sort of real mysteries for scientists studying coral reefs is how do they all synchronize that release? They can't talk to each other. You know, there's no enticing mating dance going on here. So what is it? Because if they didn't release all their eggs and sperm at the same time, you wouldn't get fertilization.
Mm-hmm.
So scientists think it has something to do with the phase of the moon and the tide, the water temperature, possibly the amount of sunlight that at that time. And it might also be that once one releases, it might also release a chemical in the water to synchronize it. So it's one of those mysteries that scientists haven't quite figured out yet.
And you've actually witnessed this happening.
I have. I've been fortunate enough to be underwater on scuba at night. Basically, we went to see this, and you could see the little eggs floating up and the sperm. And one of the things that happens is that's yummy fish food. And so worms and fish and all sorts of things start swarming. It's like a feeding frenzy on the coral, sperm and eggs, as they're floating up.
Hmm. So they float up, they fertilize, and then they sort of drift around. And how do they find their way back to a reef?
That's a very good question. Again, this is a something that scientists aren't quite sure. But what happens is once they fertilize, they become larvae, and they're plankton, and they float around depending on where they are, what the currents are, sort of what the bottom is like. They float around until something happens, and they get a chemical cue, or the conditions are just right, and they settle to the seafloor, and there they metamorphose into a little tiny coral,
mm-hmm.
but what triggers them to settle, we're not quite sure.
And the cool thing about corals is that when you have these large reefs, a lot of it is composed of a lot of the hard material when it's the hard corals is composed of things that have been around for, hundreds of years sometimes?
Well, hundreds or even thousands of years. Mm-hmm. You know, you see a coral and there's so much life. You know, it's on its surfaces, swimming around in all the holes. But the truth is, the live part of the coral is only a tiny bit of the surface. Most of what's underneath is actually hard rock. It's limestone. And that kind of creates the architecture of an underwater city.
Hmm. What happens if you drill into a coral reef?
Well, it depends on where you drill and sort of how you do it. I mean, you can drill into places that are rubble, and, you know, that's not a problem. You can. Scientists actually take cores out of coral skeletons themselves, the individual corals, because you can actually use that to look at the history of the ocean and the planet's past.
Almost like an ice core sample.
Very similar to an ice core. In fact, what they do is they cut a very thin section of that core, and then they x-ray it, like you would go to a hospital. They x-ray it, and a coral has bands, almost like tree rings, but they have they create two bands a year, high-density and low-density bands. So you can figure out how old the coral is. You can look and see if there's been stress to those bands. So it's really an interesting way of studying coral reefs.
So once again, an interesting bellwether for the way that the oceans and the climate are changing.
Very much so. It's one of the ways scientists study climate change, because you can also drill tiny samples out of the skeleton, and since you know what the age they are, you know what years it is, and you can do geochemical analysis, and you can get what the temperature of the water was when that coral laid down the skeleton.
Writer and consultant Ellen Prager is former chief scientist at the undersea research facility Aquarius Reef Base in the Florida Keys. Her new book is called Sex, Drugs, and Sea Slime, The Ocean's Oddest Creatures and Why They Matter. We'll talk about lots more with Ellen Prager in just a couple of minutes, and you can join us by calling in now to 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. If you would like to read a copy of this really amazing book that, you know, I have kids, so this was one of those books that I have for work that they actually are really interested in and sit on the arm of my chair while I'm doing my studying. It's not a children's book per se, but it would be interesting to older kids. It is available at or above the $120 contribution level when you go online to kera.org or when you call in to 1-888-694-6931. Hey, Jeff.
Hello, Chris. I want to thank Heather Horner in Dallas, Don Louis in Flower Mound, and Miriam Van Steenlant in Dallas for contributing to the station here in the last hour or so. We'd love to thank you. When you go online to kera.org, when you call 888-694-6931, we'll get an update here shortly for you. But last time we were in a break, we were about 81,900 and change from wrapping this drive up. And it's 80,744 left to raise
in
the drive. Just $80,700. So that's great. So please be the next one to make your contribution and help us. Let's get it as low as we can before we get to 2 o'clock today.
Your participation really matters. It counts, and it helps to pay your public radio expenses. We are billed by the national producers of programming according to how many people listen, not how many people contribute. So if you are a listener, you are part of the expense, quite literally, that we pay to provide you with national programming. Of course, local programming we produce ourselves here, but there is an expense associated with that. We work really hard to keep our expenses down so that we can ask you for as little money as possible, as few times a year as possible, but we do have to do it, and we try to be as transparent as possible. KERA relies on your support to serve you. 1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can also make a contribution of support at kera.org.
888-694-6931. Online at KERA.org. And as Chris mentioned, we do have copies of Ellen Prager's new book, Sex, Drugs, and Sea Slime, The Ocean's Oddest Creatures and Why They Matter. When you join the station at the $120 level or higher, we would be thrilled to send you a copy of the book.
You will really like this book. I have to say, my husband, I kept calling out facts to him the other night after the kids went to bed about interesting things I was learning. If you like science and you like interesting science and little chatty things to talk about with your friends, this is a great book for you to read.
And you can always say, you know, and I heard about it. I heard about it on KERA.
I heard about it on Think.
Yeah. How often do you say that? Do you have those conversations with your friends? You know you do. You know you say, oh, I was listening to KERA the other day. Or maybe you say, I heard it on NPR. And a lot of people say that because we are the NPR affiliate here for North Texas. We're not technically NPR, but we're part of NPR. And we're thrilled to be able to bring you NPR programming every single day. We just ask that you decide what that's worth to you and put a value on it and pick up that phone and call us at 888-694-6931.
We know it's worth something because you spend so much time with us. For many of us, our time is even more valuable than our money. So consider that when you're making your contribution of support right now. You can go online to kera.org and check out thank you gifts, including Ellen Prager's Sex, Drugs, and Slime book, The Ocean's Oddest Creatures and Why They Matter. You can also make your gift of support over the phone by calling 1-888-694-6931. Back in just a minute with interesting lobster facts with Ellen Prager.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Summer Youth Programs. Camps in Legos, writing, art, reading, math, and science held at SMU in Plano and on the main campus, Dallas. Learn more at smu.edu/summeryouth.
Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer, consultant, and former chief scientist at the undersea research facility Aquarius Reef Base, Ellen Prager. Her new book is called Sex, Drugs, and Sea Slime, The Ocean's Oddest Creatures and Why They Matter. Join the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Okay, Ellen, hands down, my favorite chapter, all about the lobsters, because there are so many things I did not know, starting with the fact that they have to shed those really hard, crusty shells a lot.
Yep, it's, you know, basically, if you think about any of the crustaceans, if you have a hard shell, it's very rigid, and you're growing, you know, you basically you grow too big for your the shell, so they've got to get a new one. And the only way they can do that is by sort of breaking out of the old one and forming a new one. And that's called molting.
And they don't have, like, lobster crackers down there, so how do they do it from within?
Exactly. Yep, there's no lobster crackers. Well, it's kind of a funny process. It basically, you know, it's sort of, they diet for a little while to get a little space between their bodies and their shells, their exoskeleton, and then they drink a lot of seawater and basically cause themselves to bloat. And it's kind of one of these, you know, they bloat so much that they kind of unzip their shells. And they kind of break through it.
Doesn't that hurt them?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. What I kept envisioning was, you know, in the main lobster, you've got those really big claws, and you've got sort of a narrow, slender, almost like a wrist.
Yeah.
And so they have to pull their claws, you know, the sort of, they're like jelly-like claws, through those slender wrists, kind of thought of like, pulling a bloated hand through a, you know, a handcuff or something.
And yeah.
You know, to me, it kind of seems like it must hurt, but who knows? You know, they have to do it. They have to keep doing it throughout their lives every time they molt. So even that, maybe, you know, maybe it's just something they get used to, but it doesn't sound very pleasant to me.
And I suppose for the females, if there's a benefit to this, it's that molting time is also mating time.
Well, you know, the males have to have access to their private parts. So when the
so the shell is normally like a chastity belt when they have shells.
I guess you could say that. I think it may do that.
Okay. So but they have to be recently molted in order to mate.
Yeah, they basically have to sort of once the females seduce a male, essentially, she comes out of her shell, so to speak.
And she seduces him in a way that most of us would find revolting.
Well, it turns out that when two lobsters meet, he matters. So the main lobster actually has these two super soaker blaster nozzles on her head, and she shoots him with a stream of urine that kind of acts like love potion number 9. And so instead of smacking her over the head with his claw, he says, "Oh, come into my den."
How do they keep from being eaten when their exoskeletons are soft between hard shell phases?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And in fact, basically, they hide. When they are molting, they will find rocks and crevices and things to molt in. They don't typically do it out in the open because they're so vulnerable. And in Maine, when they actually collect lobsters and they call them shedders, and their shells are still soft. It's, you know, just after they've molted, and they haven't quite hardened yet. So they're very vulnerable when they've shedded because it takes a while for that. Basically, exoskeleton or shell to form.
When you say they collect them, are you talking about people who trade in lobsters to sell people to eat? Okay.
The fishermen, actually, there are certain times of the year when the lobsters are molting, and they will collect them, and they call them shedders. And you can see them sometimes when you go to buy a lobster, it will say a shedder, and they will be softer shelled.
I'm also really curious about lobster migration because spiny lobsters, I never knew this, form this little conga line on the seafloor.
They do. It's amazing. In the tropics, we find spiny lobsters in the Bahamas, off of Florida, in the Caribbean. The beginning of the winter, maybe sort of in the autumn, all of a sudden the spiny lobsters will sort of create a single file offshore express going from shallow water, and they will literally march one after another in single file offshore. And we think it's because they're trying to avoid the cold water that's brought on by winter storms.
Why do they need to travel in a line?
You know, again, we're not quite sure. Some hypothesize that it's kind of like a professional car or bike racer where you get dragged by being right behind somebody. It's easier to go.
Uh-huh.
That might be one reason. Another reason is it might be a way to be guided because they, you know, basically they're head to tail, so that it guides them in the same place.
So, like, one guy has the directions and everybody
else
is following.
Yeah, one guy has the directions and the rest are following. It could be a way, maybe it's protection against predators if it looks like it's a bigger organism or something, mm-hmm. a group.
I did not read this in the book, but why do they change color when they, do you know that, when we cook them?
It has something to do with the chemicals in their shells.
Mm-hmm. It's been a while since I've eaten lobster, but I was wondering also about, they're not as bad for you as people tend to think they are. We always associate lobsters with cholesterol and things like that.
We do, in fat, but in reality, they're not that high in cholesterol and fat. It's just that everybody, you know, likes to soak them in butter.
Oh, so there's where you get all the fat.
There's where you get all the fat. That's right.
Okay, so I'll move on from lobsters after this one more question because
okay.
Maybe I'm the only one who's this fascinated. But I was interested that they can, like a lot of other marine animals, can regenerate lost parts. But if they lose an eye, they cannot grow back an eye.
It appears that way. I mean, that's what the observations by scientists have been, that, you know, if they're in a fight and they lose a claw or they might lose a leg, they can regenerate it, which, in fact, there's a lot of animals in the ocean that can do this. But for some reason, if they lose an eye, they're kind of out of luck. And, you know, in fact, you might get growing there a weird placed leg or something instead.
Wow, so a different body part will grow in there.
Yeah, it's very odd.
And this sort of research is interesting, and there's other animals that do this as well, because potentially there could be implications somewhere down the line for human beings to unlock the secret of this?
Well, that, you know, you have to think that way. I mean, there are quite a few animals in the ocean that can regenerate body parts, and how do they do that? And I think that in the future it may help us in treating injuries, producing maybe new, maybe even producing new body parts, you know, which people are already working on. But it's there are a lot of things about animals in the ocean that we're really just starting to learn for. I think about it in terms of, you know, these animals have evolved over hundreds of millions of years. Nature got it right.
Mm-hmm.
And we're really just starting to learn not only and use them as models in biotechnology, but for medicines and biomedical research, learning more about physiology.
So I had heard before that octopuses can camouflage themselves, but I didn't know they do this lightning fast and they do it colorblind.
Well, there's a researcher up in Woods Hole, Roger Hanlon, who's been studying their camouflage capabilities and has done these amazing experiments. And what he found over the years was, in fact, that they're colorblind, which kind of makes you scratch your head. If they're mm-hmm. colorblind, how the heck can they perfectly match, like you said, lightning speed, the color of the bottom? And when I spoke to him about it, he said that he thinks they may have color-sensing capabilities in their skin. He hasn't found it yet. That's his suspicion, which would be really cool.
Hmm.
You know, and if you think about it, you know, who might be interested in using that kind of in their technology?
Well, it seems like everybody. There'd be lots of applications for that.
Yeah, but in particular, the military is very interested. Imagine if you had color-changing wetsuits that could blend in with the background.
Mm-hmm.
I like to think of it as, you know, that could produce the real Harry Potter cloak.
Oh, sure, the invisibility cloak.
The invisibility cloak, right. So very interested. We don't know how they do it yet, and that, you know, there's a lot of research going on into that. And again, it's can we learn from nature and apply it to human society?
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest this hour, Ellen Prager, whose new book is called Sex, Drugs, and Sea Slime, The Ocean's Oddest Creatures and Why They Matter. Let's go on the phones now to Colin in Dallas. Hey, Colin.
Well, hello, Chris, and hello, Alan, Ellen. What a phenomenal show. I was just talking to my son 2 days ago about this. He's 9 and wants to start scuba diving.
Oh, get him the book. He's going to love it.
He will love it, and I will get it. I was off the coast of Hawaii 20 years ago when I witnessed something I did not know what it was till years later. It was indeed a coral bloom. It was phenomenal. The whole entire coral bank off the Big Island by the Black Sands Beach just burst to life. spontaneously. And it was a sight to behold. I've never forgotten that, and that was 20 years ago. And as I was calling to tell you about that, I hear you talking about the splendor of the spiny lobsters in Florida, which I got to witness on a night dive one time. And I'm rather envious of your line of work, quite frankly. It sounds very, very exciting.
Thanks so much for your call.
You're welcome.
So, Ellen, talk for a minute about this undersea lab that you worked in. It's like a trailer underwater that you stay in for weeks at a time.
It is. It's the only undersea research station in the world. It's located about 4 miles offshore Key Largo in Florida. And basically, teams of scientists or even astronauts or Navy divers will go and live in it for about 1 to 2 weeks to either train or study the surrounding coral reefs. And the advantage is, instead of coming up after every dive, you get to stay down and you get 6 to 9 hours a day diving down to 100 feet, starting from 50 feet, because that's where you're living.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the advantage. It gives you time and access to do research or train.
And you travel to it, right? It doesn't come up and take passengers on and go back down.
No, it stays. It is basically fixed on the seafloor, and so you do a regular scuba dive down into it, and you use scuba tanks when you're outside diving from it. So you're really inside the habitat just to eat, sleep, drink, work up your data, do communications and things like that. But most of your day is actually spent outside on scuba tanks doing whatever work you're doing.
Is it hard to come back up after all that time? Do you have to be really careful?
You have to go through 17 hours of decompression inside the habitat. So basically what they do is they just shut the door, and they can change the pressure from the surface, and you go through basically overnight. They slowly bring it back up to the surface pressure.
Ellen Prager is with us. She's a writer, consultant, and former chief scientist at the undersea research facility Aquarius Reef Base. Her new book is called Sex, Drugs, and Sea Slime, The Ocean's Oddest Creatures and Why They Matter. Join us by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. If you would like to read Ellen Prager's book and also you are ready to support KERA with a contribution at or above the $120 level, have we got a deal for you. It is available as a thank you gift when you call in to 1-888-694-6931 or also online at kera.org. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. We're making incredible progress today. Just now, we've beaten down below before the last break, the $80,000 mark. We were above $80,000 during the last break. So it's really exciting to see that there's just over $79,000 left to raise. We started at noon today with around $84,000 to raise in the drive. So we're making incredible progress. And thanks so much to people like Bradley Adams in Dallas, Mona Davis in Austin, Susan and Daniel O'Brien in Gun Barrel City. We also heard from Jan Trebig in Arlington. Maybe it's Jan. Jan or Jan, thank you so much. Kathy Gregory in Dublin, Texas. And Mark and Tracy Glidewell in Colleyville. We're hearing from folks all over North Texas and even beyond. We heard from Austin. Because these folks value what they get from KERA, whether it's on the air at 90.1 or on the web at kera.org, you're finding something that you identify with on this radio station. We would really appreciate it if you would help out with a financial contribution either there at kera.org or on the phone at 1-888-694-6931.
Of course, we are always happy to accept a contribution from you, but we won't be in another membership campaign for something like 5 months. So this is a great time. If you've been thinking you wanted to get around to it, do it now. Help us to put this drive to bed and know that you have paid for another great year of public radio in your community, or maybe another great year of podcasts if you are a podcast listener from anywhere. You can make your gift of support online at kera.org, or you can call 1-888-694-6931.
Your contribution, your generous contribution, has a direct impact on what this station is able to do for you every single day. Without your contributions, we would only have 39% of our current revenue required to run the station. That means that every hour-long show would end at 23 minutes or so.
We're just getting started at that point.
Figuratively, yes. I mean, that means that we'd only be able to do a little bit. You know, we wouldn't be able to bring you all the shows that you listen to. I mean, there would be a whole lot of nothing on KERA. Your contributions make up 61% of the budget here at KERA of the revenue budget that is necessary to pay the bills like programming fees to NPR and PRI and phone bills to, in the last hour, Oxford, England, in this hour to reach Ellen Prager, on the I believe, on the East Coast. So we're just, you know, we managed to get by because of your contributions. And that's why it's perfectly fair for us to ask that you do your part right now at KERA.org or on the phone at 1-888-694-6931.
Those of us on the staff are also listeners, and we're right in there with you. We are, I think, almost without exception, we're members voluntarily. There's no rule when you come to work here that you have to be a supporting member, but we value the product so much that we turn around and, you know, earn money from the station and then give some of it back because we're listeners as well. If you'd like to join us in this effort and be part of the team that makes KERA possible, you can do so right now online at KERA.org or at 1-888-694-6931.
Just $78,879 left to raise in the drive. Remember this morning we were well over 100,000 still, so I believe. So we've made incredible progress thanks to each and every one of you who has called 888-694-6931, or thanks to each and every one of you who has contributed at KERA.org. It just takes a couple of minutes. Really, I'm starting to think that if we have another couple of good breaks here during Think, there's a chance we could successfully wrap up this membership campaign today. But that means that you need to get involved right now. Go to the phone, 888-694-6931, or go to the web at KERA.org and join this winning team right now.
It's easy to do. It really does not take a lot of time. So that if you get online right now or go to the phones right now at 1-888-694-6931, you're likely to be done with your transaction by the time we come on in about 3 minutes back with Ellen Prager. So give us a call now or go online to KERA.org. Check out the thank you gifts if you're interested, including Ellen Prager's book, Sex, Drugs, and Sea Slime, The Ocean's Oddest Creatures and Why They Matter. We also have copies, additionally, of last hour's book, The Arabs, A History by Eugene Rogan. So you can ask for that as well if you want to make a contribution at or above $120.
As a matter of fact, all the authors we've talked to over the last 2 weeks, their books are all available online at KERA.org. You can check that out if you heard a show in the last couple of days, the last couple of weeks. All those books are available still as thank you gifts during this membership campaign. Just check it out at KERA.org.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number if you'd prefer to make your contribution that way. If you can do it online, which we love because it's just a little bit cheaper to process that membership for this station, you can do that at KERA.org. Either way, we would love to hear from you now. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's summer youth programs, camps in Legos, writing, art, reading, math, and science held at SMU in Plano and on the main campus, Dallas. Learn more at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer, consultant, and former chief scientist Ellen Prager. She worked at the undersea research facility Aquarius Reef Base. Her new book is called Sex, Drugs, and Sea Slime, The Ocean's Oddest Creatures and Why They Matter. If you've got a question or an observation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Ellen, I want to talk now about the strangest cephalopod on the planet, the let me see if I'm saying this right, Vampyrotuthis infernalis.
That's right, the vampire squid.
And it is, not only is it not very mean, but it has some really cool ways of finding its what it's going to eat.
Well, you know, one thing is that we don't, there's a lot we don't know about it. You know, basically, we've got pictures of it, and we can look at it and sort of figure out what it might do. But yes, it has these. It looks like it has these tentacles that, you know, it has its arms, but it also has these tentacles that look like little fishing sort of lines that it can deploy and maybe catch things, and then they pull them back in.
And then it can glow as well.
Well, it actually, we think. This is very unusual. A lot of animals in the ocean are bioluminescent. That is, they produce light biologically. Mm-hmm. But the vampire squid, it looks like it has special organs at the tips of its arms that it can fire beads of glowing slime.
Wow, more slime.
More slime. I tell you, there's a lot down there. And we think what it does is that maybe if it's threatened, you know, it might fire all this glowing slime and sort of create a decoy or a smoke screen of glowing mucus in the water around it. But again, that's just a guess from what scientists have recorded in photographs and seen.
It must just be amazing to be down there in your scuba gear and see bioluminescent fish. Can you just describe, I mean, it seems like poetic more than scientific.
It's amazing. You know, for those kind of pictures, they're probably in a submersible or with a remotely operated vehicle. But in scuba diving at night, in the Caribbean and certain places in the Galapagos, you can often see bioluminescence. And it's most obvious when in places where you pass your hand through the water and it's like little twinkling lights behind it.
Hmm.
And it what's happening is that the water movement is causing small dinoflagellates or algae to basically release a spark of light. But when you see it happen, you know, honestly, I have to say, even as a scientist, you're not like, oh, well, what's the chemical reaction causing that? You're kind of, instead, you're just wowed. You know, I've seen, when I've been diving at night, I've seen a sea lion swim by and do like somersaults and a trail of sparkling lights behind them.
Wow.
Yeah, really amazing.
Sea stars are cool little creatures as well, and they are among those that can regenerate, as a lot of people know, a lost limb. How long does that take?
You know, honestly, I don't know how long it takes them to regenerate a limb, but what many people don't know, which I think was really amazing, is not only can they regenerate a limb, but if a limb breaks off with a central portion of the disc, they can actually regenerate a body around the arm.
Wow.
I know, you know what? The only thing, when I was reading about this and doing the research, the thing I could just imagine is one of those, you know, bad horror movies with the sort of arm moving around on the floor, kind of like that.
Yeah, it would be scary because if you chop somebody up in enough parts, you have an army of scary creatures.
Yeah, so, but again, you know, how do they do that?
There's other kinds of interesting reproduction, including, is it the anglerfish that sort of bites down for life?
The anglerfish, oh, that's a really bizarre one. And that is, it turns out in the deep sea anglerfish, the females are much bigger than the males. And the males sort of swim around, their mission in life is just to find a female, and they find one, and they bite on, and then their lips become fused to the females, and they essentially become just a parasitic sperm producer for the rest of its life.
Wow.
Yeah. It's, you know, what a way to go, I guess.
And the anglerfish, they're not the ones that can change their gender, right?
No, those are parrotfish.
Parrotfish, right.
The anglerfish is just the parasitic attachment. Now, and again, getting back to this medical issues and sort of how we can learn from them, scientists are actually studying that because think about your immune systems and rejection. You know, how does the female accept that male, and how does it become a part of its body? So scientists are studying their immune system and endocrinology associated with that.
Hmm. And there's also some interesting research in terms of things like bottom feeders, how they don't get sick from eating decomposing materials.
That's right. This I found this really interesting. The hagfish, which is this really funny, it looks kind of like an eel. They are also called, the slime monster, slime hag, because they, to deter predators, create huge amounts of slime. But they feed on dead and dying things at the bottom of the ocean. And so scientists are trying to figure out how they don't become sick, because things that are dead tend to have a lot of bacteria and microbes in them. And they've already discovered several very interesting antimicrobial compounds associated with these hagfish.
Are those compounds in the slime, or are they just in the fish's
body?
No,
they're in the hagfish's body. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so there's a question of, you know, how do they, what's their immune system? And then, you know, how are they not getting sick by eating all of these things?
And you can find hagfish, like, in Maine, and right?
Well, you'd have to fish for them. They're actually in, they basically live in deep water, but there's hundreds of thousands of them living in the Gulf of Maine in the deep water. And you don't really have to worry about them unless you're sort of dead or dying.
And then you're probably in trouble anyway.
Yeah. I have to say, thinking about the hagfish, Burial at sea, maybe not.
Let's go back to the parrotfish, which we talked about earlier. They swim in these schools, mostly female parrotfish, and like one guy, one very lucky guy. But if something happens to him, it's not a problem.
Well, they have what we call them harems. And in the harem, if the dominant male dies or, you know, something happens, turns out within a couple weeks, one of the females can change into a male. And sometimes they become super males. They become very big, aggressive, and extremely colorful. Hmm. But, you know, the thought is they do this so that some outsider can't come in and usurp the group.
Any idea how they decide which one does this, or maybe only some of them have, only some females have the capability to change?
You know, that's a great question. I don't know. We know it appears that hormones drive the change, but which one gets to do it? Could be the most dominant female in the group is the one that gets to change. But, you know, I honestly, personally, I don't know the answer to that question. But my guess would be it might have something to do with the social hierarchy within that harem.
Another really interesting animal with medical implications is the cone snail, because it has different kinds of venom depending on the enemy.
This is really interesting. The cone snail, which is sort of the beautiful but lethal snail of the sea, some of the most venomous cone snails actually hunt fish. You know, think about how can a snail hunt a fish? They have these harpoon-like teeth that they shoot out that are on tethers, and so they can harpoon a fish, start pulling them in, and then they inject venom to paralyze the fish. Hmm. Some feed on fish, some may feed on worms and other things, but the most deadly ones feed on fish, and different species have different venom, and even more surprising, they can actually change their venom between strikes.
Wow.
And so scientists actually believe that this one organism, the cone snail, has the most potential of any animal on the planet for pharmaceuticals. And already on the market, there's a painkiller called Prialt, and it's a non-opiate, so it's not a morphine-based, you know, morphine kind of drug. So people who become allergic or addicted to morphine can take this Prialt, which comes from the cone snail venom.
Hmm. You know, hearing about all this, it's almost, Ellen, like these are animals from another planet rather than just another environment in our planet. And yet so many of them are so vulnerable right now. Can you talk about some of the ways that people who care about the health of the oceans can, if nothing else, do no harm?
Well, you're 100% right. You know, unfortunately, the biggest threat in the ocean, it's not, you know, some major predator, it's us. And there are significant problems that are putting this great diversity of life at risk, things like pollution and climate change, overfishing. But every individual can make a difference. We can make smart choices in the fish we eat. There's a lot of guides out there that tell you what's sustainably caught, so what's a good fish to eat. You know, here in Miami, we have a real problem with trash. If people throw their trash and it gets blown into the ocean, or even if you're inland and it goes down in a river into the ocean, that can do real harm. And so recycling, disposing of your trash properly, and people can have a voice for the ocean. We don't talk about the ocean in terms of jobs and food and the economy, but they're inherently connected. And so as we invest in getting people back to work and in our economy here in the United States and around the world, we need to invest in keeping the ocean safe. And so I always ask people, you know, write to your political leaders and tell them that you care about the ocean, and we need to make better policies, and it needs to be a higher priority.
Ellen Prager's new book is called Sex, Drugs, and Sea Slime, The Ocean's Oddest Creatures and Why They Matter. Ellen, this has been a lot of fun and very interesting. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Well, thank you, and I hope you're talking about sharing it with your kids, and I think this is the kind of book that there's so many fun stories that people of any age will like.
I agree.
And there's a good message. It's not only fun, silly stories. You know, you can really learn about the connections from this sort of weird sea life to our own lives.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks to all of you who have been listening this hour and participating and making contributions to make sure that we can bring you interviews like this one with Ellen Prager. I really did just
thoroughly enjoy the conversation and the book. We hope that you did as well. Jeff and I hope that it's clear to you that we really love making this show for you. Your contributions make it possible. We're here and we're employed here, but the show exists because of you, not simply for you, but because you support it financially.
Yeah, you know, just to give you a glimpse behind, I did hear Ellen Prager on Fresh Air a couple of weeks ago, and she's done a couple of different interviews on public radio shows. We had the book. We knew that it was going to be really interesting. I thought it'd be perfect for during the membership campaign. But to give you a little glimpse on how the editorial process works, I was looking at, in another sense, I was looking at the issue of The New Yorker. It's a couple weeks old. We always get behind, right? And I noticed this profile of David Eagleman, who's the neuroscientist.
We've had him on twice before.
We've had him on. I thought, oh, yeah, we've had him on. He's great. And reading about it. And then the very next day, we got a review copy of his new book in the mail, which comes out in a couple of weeks. And you know, we both took a look at it, and we're really excited to you know, try to work that into the schedule in the coming weeks. Well, that's happening, you know, every day on your behalf, because we know that when we talked with David Eagleman a couple of years ago about synesthesia, we got an overwhelming response from so many of you. That's just a little glimpse behind how it happens for each different guest.
We also say no to a lot of things on your behalf.
We do indeed. Although Chris's mention of teen fashion the other day, I was thinking, how could we work that in? But no, it's, you know, that's what it's all about. We are here making decisions every day about who we're going to talk to, what we're going to talk to them about, what are the topics that are important to you here in North Texas as an active, engaged listener of public radio. Hopefully, you're an active, engaged listener of public radio who is deciding to become an active, engaged supporter of public radio. And that means sending, you know, a couple of 20s to the radio station. You can do that online at KERA.org. You can call 888-694-6931. Consider 620s, sending 620s to the radio station for $120. And we'll thank you with a copy of Ellen Prager's book.
You know, it is a little bit like caring about the oceans from a distance but not doing anything. The ocean gets no healthier if you don't take action or, you know, make sure that it stays in good shape. It's the same thing. You know, KERA doesn't get any stronger if you just listen. We're really happy you're listening, but just listening is not enough to keep the station operating. If everybody in the audience just listened and didn't make contributions, we would not be here. And so we are so grateful to those of you who recognize that and who make KERA a priority in, you know, perhaps you have multiple not-for-profit institutions that you contribute to. This is one that not only serves your community, but it serves you directly. So it seems like a really easy choice to make. We'd love to hear from you now at KERA.org or online at 1-888-694-6931.
And if you have, you know, charitable commitments that preclude you from joining the station, by all means, I mean, if your charitable giving is necessary to save someone's life or to save the ocean, you know, if that's what you decide is important, and that's where your budget to make a charitable contribution goes, well, that's great, because that's what it's all about. And hopefully someday you'll be at a place when you can support KERA, a station that maybe turned you on through one of our shows or another interview on another show to a cause that is important to you. I would hope that's the case. Maybe that was the case in the past, and now you can support KERA. Maybe, you know, your priority is putting food on the table for your family. You know what? The station is here for you to bring you, you know, informative news and information that in some cases can actually help you weather the economic challenges that we faced lately. And maybe someday you'll be able to support KERA to thank the station for that kind of news and information. And again, maybe you're there today. If you are there today, please do your part right now online at KERA.org or call 888-694-6931. We have just $78,000 left to raise in this drive, and that sounds like a lot of money because it is a lot of money, but compared to the $625,000 we started looking for a couple weeks ago, we're almost there.
This is your source for NPR News, 90.1 KERA, Dallas, Fort Worth, Denton, and online at KERA.org. Your financial support matters to the station. It keeps it strong and healthy, and it provides you 24-hour-a-day programming. You can tune in at any time. You know, if, like me, sometimes you have trouble sleeping at night, there's nothing like turning on the radio so you're not so lonely in the middle of the night trying to fall asleep when the rest of the house is sound asleep. During the day, hopefully we keep you wide awake with the content and information that we have for you. We're proud to be able to bring you this service. And honestly, we're proud of your trust in us. When you send us your money, we understand that we have a an awesome responsibility. And it means a lot to us that you are willing to make a financial contribution of support to KERA. If you would like to join the great folks who are part of the team that makes KERA possible, you can go online now to kera.org. You can also call on the phone at 1-888-694-6931. Perhaps choose a copy of Ellen Prager's book, Sex, Drugs, and Sea Slime. Thanks, and have a great afternoon.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.